for FM News 101.
Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. This week, broadcasting live from Stanford University.
This university will no longer continue any funding of any kind for your group's activity.
Home to some of the greatest minds of our time. Phil Knight, Hewlett and Packard, the founders of Yahoo, PayPal, and even Lars's mom. Since Lars never graduated college, he's bringing some of the brightest minds on air so he can learn something.
Republicans, are you prepared to go into this fight?
Now, live from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University.
You can inspire their devotion to American ideals.
Here's Lars Larson.
Mr. Bobulinski, who's the big guy?
Joe Biden.
Are you sure about that? Because when...
Joe Biden.
You sure?
I'm 1,000% sure.
He's 1,000% sure. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. That is Tony Bobulinski just a few hours ago. And if you don't remember the name of Tony Bobulinski, I don't blame you. I mean, this has become a complicated scenario to watch. But Tony Bobulinski was one of the business partners of Hunter Biden. That's right. The same Hunter Biden, coked up and everything else, who cut all those sleazy deals, but he did manage to bring in tens of millions of dollars. The current estimate is about $30 million. For the Biden crime family. That's right. The family that's headed up by the capo, Joe Biden, who now sits in the Oval Office of the United States acting like the President of the United States. Well, I guess that's kind of diminishing President of the United States, isn't it? Because Joe Biden barely knows where he is most of the time. He's tempted to wander off stage at times. He goes off into babble. In fact, just this week, he saw a baby in an audience, I believe it was in Arizona, and he actually went off the stage. He said he couldn't resist the idea of going out and kissing a baby. Maybe that's what the now senile president of the United States thinks of as campaigning for re-election. I gotta kiss some babies. He's a creepy guy for sure. But today, I think, was a watershed moment, and I want to share some of the most significant parts of the testimony with you. But let me get to that in a moment. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, you disagree with me, maybe you think the big guy, Joe Biden, was not up to something really nefarious that benefited his family to the tune of tens of millions of dollars by peddling his influence overseas, and you don't think that Joe Biden deserves to be impeached. Well, he ought to be impeached. And I think today's testimony ought to really come home to Americans. Here's Tony Bobulinski, who served as a United States naval officer in the nuclear power part of the United States Navy. He served with honor. He served with distinction. He left the Navy. He made his own money. He didn't go out and cut sleazy deals by peddling influence overseas the way Jim and Joe and Hunter Biden have done. So he gave his opening statement before the House Oversight Committee today. And I know that a lot of you, I would even admit that I've given up a little bit of hope that things are going to actually get fixed, that we're going to see real justice come to Joe Biden and James Biden and Hunter Biden as well. But Tony Bobulinski, with really nothing much to gain, and I'm sure there are plenty of people who hate this guy, including a member of Congress, and I'll play that soundbite in just a moment, but in his opening statement, he described how the first son, Hunter Biden, his uncle, James Biden, were lying under oath about the nature of their business dealings with the Chinese energy conglomerate known as CEFC. Take a listen to what he told members of Congress today.
Though the truth involving the deep corruption of the Biden family, including the malfeasance of the sitting president of the United States, might be raw and unpleasant, the American people must hear it. You're presented here today with two narratives in this investigation, a false one being pushed by Joe Biden, a serial liar and fabulist now under this impeachment investigation for public corruption, his brother Jim Biden, a 75-year-old man who can't keep his lies straight, including under oath, and his son, Hunter Biden, a chronic drug addict facing two indictments with 12 counts.
Now, imagine all that and what he talked about, because he's testified behind closed doors, and he's also testified. At the beginning of his testimony, I got a kick out of the fact that he said, hey, I thought I was going to give my opening statement after Hunter Biden. Is Hunter Biden here? No, Hunter Biden was not there. In fact, Hunter Biden has defied the Congress and simply refused to show up for a subpoena. Now, you know what happened this week? One of the people most loyal to President Trump, Peter Navarro, you've heard him on this program before, he actually had to submit himself to federal prison. He will be locked up for 4 months. And what was his great crime? His great crime was defying a subpoena from the United States Congress. So if you're aligned with President Trump, and there are few of his staff who are as loyal to President Trump as Peter Navarro, if you say to the Congress, I'm not coming down there, I'm not answering your questions, and you're Peter Navarro, you go to prison for 4 months. If you're Hunter Biden and the Congress says show up and answer some questions, and you basically tell the Congress to pound sand, you get away with it scot-free. Now tell me that anybody thinks that is a legitimate way to run a justice system with two standards. One standard for conservatives. And it's not just politicians who are allied with President Trump who are among those who get targeted this way. Pro-life people get targeted this way. Churches are burned down in some cases. Religion is attacked in this country. And the Biden administration and the federal authorities don't seem to give a damn. But if you're BLM, if you're Antifa, if you're on the other side of the aisle, you get favorable treatment. So Bob Alinsky cited three examples of perjury from Hunter Biden when he talked about what his father had done in line with their business. Number one, the timeline of his business relationship with CEFC, his father's interactions with Hunter Biden's business associates, and the threatening text that he sent to a Chinese businessman in which he demanded payment and said, I'm sitting right here next to my father. He peddled his father's influence and used Joe Biden to back up threats to get literally millions of dollars. And I want to remind you of something. In the presidential debates in the fall of 2020, so this would have been October of 2020, Joe Biden stood right there on a stage. He was facing Donald Trump, something it sounds as he's not likely to repeat this year. He's afraid of the kind of things Trump could say. And Trump said, you and your family have been making money in China. And Joe Biden explicitly denied that he was making money in China. He denied knowing anything about his son's business. That was a lie. He denied that his family was making money in China. That was a lie. The corruption goes deep. Listen to Tony Bobulinski call out those lies.
Rep. Dan Goldman and Jamie Raskin, both lawyers, and Mr. Goldman, a former prosecutor with the SDNY from New York, will continue to lie today in this hearing and then go straight to the media to tell more lies. Hunter Biden's defense attorney, Abby Lowell, weaponizes letters to Congress to try to smear my name,
Mr.
and
Chairman,
state the cold hard facts.
Mr. Chairman.
In an attempt to save his powerfully connected client.
That's Jamie Raskin breaking in.
I challenge Mr. Lowell to make those claims on national television so he can be held accountable for his lies.
Now, check this out. Representative Jamie Raskin, member of the Democrat Party, tried to use the rules of the House of Representatives to go after the witness, an American citizen named Tony Bobulinski.
He called members of this committee liars, and I just want to know whether the order and decorum requirements of House Rule 11 apply to witnesses appearing before the committee. Does it apply or does it not?
There's decorum from the members. We've asked for that. There's no language that I'm aware of pertaining to a witness.
Yeah, how about that, Jamie Raskin? The rules apply to you because you're a lying member of Congress. The rules do not apply to regular American citizens like Tony Bobulinski. And I'm glad he showed up at the U.S. Congress, something Hunter Biden won't do. And he actually said, I want people to know the truth. I want them to know about the lies of these people. Glad to be with you. Always glad to take your calls. We're live from the Hoover Broadcast Studios at Stanford, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. OregonGunLaw.com.
You are in control.
Our Constitution is a document in which we, the people, tell the government what it is allowed to do.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, fish wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
Let me just lighten up your Wednesday with a few questions that seem foolish, but they actually make a point. Do you want dead people registered to vote? Now, put a hold on the Democrat jokes. I'm actually serious about this. Do you want foreign citizens to be registered to vote in America? How about people who've moved out of state? Should they be able to cast a vote in that state's elections? Well, guess what? It's happening right here in the Pacific Northwest. Oregon and Washington both belong to something called the Electronic Register Information System, known colloquially as ERIC. It sounds pretty official, but it's actually a private company that controls the voting records of about 41% of all citizens in the United States of America, including the voting records in Oregon and Washington. Idaho has wisely decided not to be involved in this ERIC nonsense. I'll bet you thought your Secretary of State, usually the chief elections officer of any state, I'll bet you thought the Secretary of State controlled that. But no, it's in the hands of ERIC. But member states have agreed they must do what ERIC directs them to do. So you've got a private organization that has a political basis, a foundation, and they're telling the states what to do with voting records. 2 years ago, Colorado sent out registration postcards, believe it or not, to 30,000 non-citizens. Some of them were legal, some of them were illegal. They invited those 30,000 to sign up to vote. Now, as you can tell, that's not legal. And eventually Colorado said, oh, we just made a big mistake when we sent out 30,000 postcards to non-citizens inviting them to register to vote. ERIC told the state of Virginia recently to try and register 168,000 people. And if you think, well, that's a good idea, people ought to be registered to vote. These 168,000 people were either dead, had moved out of state, or were otherwise ineligible to vote. But ERIC, as I said, they have a political foundation. They said, sign these people up to vote. Did I mention that ERIC has partnered up with the official sounding Center for Election Innovation and Research, CEIR. That's another private group in these mailing efforts. CEIR, by the way, funded with tens of millions of dollars from left-winger Mark Zuckerberg of Meta. Now you get the picture. Sign up the dead, sign up non-citizens, sign up people who no longer vote in your state, and then mix in a certain amount of vote by mail. Does that sound like we're headed toward a legitimate election to you? And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I want to give the grill to the Portland Water Bureau. And why would I give it to them? They sent a bill for more than $17,000 to a family living in North Portland. They said the family had used 250,000 gallons of water between November and February. The story is detailed in the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, OregonLive.com. They said that would be enough water to fill 35 standard-sized swimming pools. Even their neighbor said, that's impossible. Even if you were filling up swimming pools 24/7, you couldn't begin to use that much water. They called in a plumber, found no leaks. Called in another plumber, found no leaks. They went to the city of Portland. What did the city say? Did they say, we'd be glad to bend over backwards to help you out? This must be a horrible mistake. Nope. City of Portland just said, well, that's what the bill is so far. I think they could be persuaded to go a different direction. Our best email so far today, you can always send more, comes from Richard. Lars, I listen to your show. I've got a question about a gun. This is an amazing story. Back in 1953, an 1800s-era pepper box gun was stolen from the McLaughlin House. That's a historic property in Oregon City. The gun was returned to us this year. Stolen in 53, returned in 2024. I'm now in the process of searching for somebody related to the lady who loaned it to the museum in 1940. I'm told after 3 years, the gun could become the property of the McLaughlin Memorial Association. And then there are other laws that deal with the state of Oregon and state of Washington, whether or not you end up owning the gun. I hooked Richard up with some of the people I know gun laws the best, and we'll see whether or not they can get some justice. But to have a gun stolen about 70 years ago and finally return is an amazing story. Now, I want to start a Wednesday with a naysayer, because we love naysayers on this program. Santiago, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling. What do you and I disagree about today that makes you a naysayer?
Hey, Lars, first of all, thanks for the good program that you always do. But
thank you.
I believe that we can never agree on anything. I mean, I called like about 10 days ago. Now, I don't know what are you talking about when you talk about this guy who was testifying today in Congress, Babulinski.
Yeah.
I mean, you were saying that this guy is an admiral, that he's an honest man and all that stuff. Listen to the way he was talking to the Congress folks at the House today. I mean, this guy was so disrespectful. And by the way, Lars, listen, if you have like you or any news organization, if you have any proof about Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, and James Biden having committed any crime, why don't they put him out there? I mean, there hasn't been...
I think that's what we're getting. Isn't that what Mr. Babulinski offered up? Mr. Babulinski served honorably in the United States Navy as an officer, left honorably, went out, started his own business, made his money legitimately and legally. He was, for a time...
And he's probably a Republican, too.
Well, I don't know whether he's Republican or not, but he worked with Hunter Biden in that business. He came to know what was going on in the business. He saw what the business was selling. Do you have any reason to believe that the Biden family made $30 million or so selling? Can you tell me what they were selling if it wasn't Joe Biden?
No. They were not selling Joe Biden. And the thing is...
Okay, hold on, Santiago. We might be able to agree. No, but we might be able to agree. Tell me what they were selling if it wasn't Joe Biden.
Well, all I can tell you and to all the listeners is that if there would have been any evidence against the President of the United States, Joe Biden, then it would have been out there in all the news outlet. So why hasn't happened? And so, no,
Santiago, can I point out to you, there are lots of people involved in financial crimes. Bernie Madoff managed to get away with his financial crimes involving far larger amounts of money for literally decades, and nobody knew it was happening until he finally got caught. But it took decades. In this case, it's taken about 10 years to track down the records, but they now have bank records that show $30 million flowing to the Biden crime family. If one of your neighbors, hold on, let me ask you a question quick before we hit the break. Santiago, if one of your neighbors said, hey, I just made $30 million, wouldn't you be inclined to say, well, what did you do that was worth $30 million? Now, when you say, well...
Well, you're right on that one. The thing is, you know, if I was you, I would be talking about Donald Trump legal issues right now.
Almost every day. Donald Trump,
Let me ask you this. Do you agree with
quick.
What he's saying?
With what Trump is saying? Yeah.
I don't know what Donald Trump was saying at his rally in Ohio about the Jews. Do you agree with that?
About which?
The Jews, the comment he made, and talking about people, the immigrants.
The Lars Larson Show. Senator John Kennedy on the Washington establishment.
The Washington establishment is working harder than an ugly stripper to cover up whatever happened.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. We're live on the campus of Stanford University in the Hoover Broadcast Studios all this week. But I want to talk about this issue straight out of the Pacific Northwest. I mean, if you didn't think that marijuana was already a giant crash and burn statewide and legalized fentanyl, heroin, etc., and all the rest of that, and And now we've got this. A guy with a suspended medical license and allegations of problems with prescription drugs that took the lives of 18 people. Why is he now being allowed, if I understand the story right, by the state of Oregon to open up a psilocybin mushroom center? Well, to talk about that, our friend Aaron Mesh, who's managing editor for Willamette Week, you can find his stories at WWeek.com, joins us now. Aaron, welcome back.
Hi, Lars. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I mean, I've been having fun down here at Stanford. It's an interesting place to be. And the Hoover Institution is fascinating. It has a nice tie back to the Pacific Northwest because Herbert Hoover had his childhood in the Northwest for most of the time that he was a kid before he went off and made his fortune and then ran for president, and the rest is history. But tell me about this guy, Dr. Frank Lee. What do we know about him?
So Dr. Frank Lee made headlines in the Pacific Northwest around 2016 and 2017 is when he was really in the news, because he ran a place called Seattle Pain Center. Seattle Pain Center had clinics, I believe 8 clinics across the state of Washington, and they were attempting, in their perspective at least, to titrate people off of opioids. That wasn't the perspective of state medical officials, or for that matter, the city of Seattle, which alleged in court filings that Frank Lee was running what they called, in their words, a pill mill.
Pill mill.
18 people died after receiving prescriptions from the Seattle Pain Center doctors. In many cases, according to court filings, the appointments to see the doctor lasted less than 5 minutes, which, as the court filing notes, is about the amount of time it takes to fill out a prescription pad. And so in 2020, Frank Lee agreed to a settlement with federal officials who had questions about urinalysis testing being done for what they said was no good reason except to make him money.
Yep.
And to settle all these accounts, he agreed that he would never again for the rest of his life prescribe more than 7 days supply of painkillers. So that's the background on him.
Which actually sounds kind of strange to me, because if you've been involved in giving or prescribing drugs for people inappropriately to the point where some of them end up dead as a result, the fact that you're allowed to stay in the pain business at all, or the opioid drug business, or any kind of drug business at all, is kind of stunning, isn't it?
Well, there's a 10-year ban on him dispensing any opioids whatsoever, and then after 10 years, he could prescribe very short supplies. Again, basically, like it would be possible for him to like work in some form of medicine again. Because if he can't prescribe any painkillers, I would imagine it would be difficult to ever get to do much medicine at all, given how crucial painkillers are to like a variety of surgeries, etc. So after 10 years, he can like essentially be a dentist. Like, you get your wisdom teeth out and get like a 6-day supply of Oxy.
Yep,
I think that happened.
Or you could go into a clinic where you work with several other doctors, and you could say, I think this patient has a lot of pain, but my fellow, you know, my partner in the clinic is going to have to actually write you the prescription on my say-so, and then it would be up to your partner, maybe a doctor who hasn't fallen under this kind of cloud, to actually say, yes, this person does need some pain meds. He could do things like that to work around it. But what's he doing now instead?
Well, he's moved to Oregon. And he has opened, actually like 6 blocks down the street from my office, he has opened a psilocybin therapy center. So now we're going to have to back up again and remind listeners who aren't keeping up with the psychedelic craze of 2024 that last year in June, the first psilocybin center opened in Oregon. These are magic mushrooms, right? These are psilocybin mushrooms, or the compound that's psychoactive inside psilocybin mushrooms, that supposedly, or according to many studies, help with depression and suicidal thoughts and a lot of other mental distress. Also, like as I understand it from like the Beatles, they make you feel nice.
And they're not a good idea for pilots that are flying for airlines, right?
No, I mean, I think that was something that would have been intuitive prior to an unfortunate incident on Alaska Airlines. But it's my understanding that if you're a pilot and you take psilocybin mushrooms, then sometimes you come to believe that the doors have fallen off the planes.
And it's time to bring the plane down. So this guy, but it wasn't just the drugs and the deaths.
You didn't get the joke there. The doors actually come off the plane.
I caught it. I thought you were trying to be subtle, so I decided to let it go by. But tell me this.
I've never been subtle. No one's ever accused me of it.
Unnecessary urine tests as well. So he's saying, I'm trying to get these people off drugs, so I'm going to have to bill Medicare and Medicaid for thousands of unnecessary urine tests as well.
Well, remember that almost all the patients at Seattle Pain Center were, in fact, Medicaid patients. So both the urinalysis tests and the prescriptions were coming out of the pocket of the taxpayer. I think that's something worth reminding your listeners of.
Did Oregon have to sign off on allowing him to open up this psilocybin psychic mushroom or psychedelic mushroom center?
Why, yes, of course they did. And the Oregon Psilocybin Services Program said, quote, upon completion of the investigation, OPS determined that the facts did not support a denial. The applicant passed the background check, and the applicant met all requirements under Oregon law to be licensed.
He passed a background check that included a background that includes 18 people who died, who were his patients at the time, and overprescribing of prescription meds and thousands of unnecessary urine tests billed off to the government. And with all that in his background, Oregon said he's good to go.
That is correct. Okay. Now, I do think that, like, it would be unkind of me, and perhaps not unfair, but unkind, not to point out that he argues that he was successfully able to titrate 22,000 people off of opioids using Seattle Pain Center's methods. That there is a different perspective that he offers on what he did, even though he agreed to the stipulated finding of facts by the federal government that his prescription resulted in death. So I think that would be worth noting. It would also be worth noting that it is not so easy to overdose on mushrooms.
No.
So some of the concern here, I don't think translates one to one, right? Like, assuming you're not piloting a Boeing aircraft, I don't know that the dangers are equivalent. So you could argue that in fact he is experimenting with therapies to help people in immense amounts of psychological or physical torment that do not have the same dangerous effects as his previous occupation. So maybe it's a happy ending.
As long as he doesn't do airline pilots. So, listen, Aaron, it's a pleasure. I'm going to recommend that people take a look at the story at WWIG.com. It's fascinating, and it kind of makes you raise some questions about state regulators. I'm not the biggest fan of government regulation, but I think regulation of this kind of stuff is absolutely essential. Aaron, thanks for the time.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
You bet. We're live at the Hoover Broadcast Studios on the Stanford University campus. We'll be back. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. And would you believe, in an election year, the Oregon legislature makes a boo-boo in a law that ends up in what even they call a windfall for teachers in their paychecks?
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. We're live on the campus of Stanford University using the studios of the Hoover Institution. And Herbert Hoover, former president of the United States, now long since passed away, has a great connection to the Pacific Northwest. He grew up there as a kid, never finished high school, but somehow managed to get into the first class at Stanford University. He remembered that later when he made it big in mining, because he actually got a degree from the college that meant something in engineering, and he decided to fund the Hoover Institution, and here it is all these decades later. So, glad to be with you. Glad to take your calls as well. And I want to put the X-Bowl question to you. Here's the question. Peter Navarro, who worked for Donald Trump the entire time that he was president, he was one of the most steadfast employees that President Trump had. And then the Congress subpoenaed him and said, you get down here and answer our questions. And Navarro effectively told them to pound sand. He wasn't going to do it. They are sending him to federal prison for 4 months for defying the Congress. Of course, Hunter Biden has done the same thing. He's been ordered to show up to answer a subpoena, to answer questions. He has defied the subpoena. Nothing is happening to Hunter Biden. So Peter Navarro went to federal prison for defying the Congress. Should Hunter Biden get the same? I would answer yes. Today's poll on X is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. To your calls now. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-439-5277. Let's start with Stacy in Yakima, listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Stacy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lars. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The reason why I'm calling is I wanted to comment what the naysayer was saying about what Bob Alinsky had to say.
Yeah.
One thing I think that the naysayer doesn't realize, I watched the impeachment hearings from like day three, four, and I watched the C-SPAN ones where you see everything.
Yep.
And J.B. Raskin was caught fabricating evidence that was shown, that was demonstrated by Trump's lawyer. It was shown right there. So Raskin has quite some audacity to call out Bob Alinsky for calling out the lying going on when he got caught fabricating evidence.
I agree with you. And Stacey, one of the things I would have asked, Santiago about if we'd had another moment, but I wanted to let him get his say said, is there an expectation, even in a polite society, and I think we are generally a polite society, Antifa and BLM to the side, we're a polite society, but if you determine that somebody you know has lied about something very important and has lied through their teeth, is there any obligation on you or me to treat them politely and not call them a liar? Because that seems like what Santiago wanted to say, that you're supposed to go in and say, I believe, Representative Raskin, that you have misspoken, rather than saying you're a liar. And I frankly don't care. I would rather have somebody call it for what it is and do it honestly than weasel around it, because there's too much weasel wording right now.
Well, I think that the issue, I understand what you're saying about weasel wording, but I am seeing, just this is just my perspective, I'm seeing a lot of sociopathic lying going on. Yep. Just in D.C. I mean, I've been watching politics for a long time. I've never seen so much sociopathic lying. It's at an epic rate. So, yeah, I agree with you. There's a standard of conduct you expect. And I think we could agree, you know, with the dissenter on that. However, I think it's such an epic proportion. I think people are just fed up with it. I am. I can speak for myself. I am fed up with that.
You and me both.
You know what I mean? It's not like this is a national security issue where you're trying to save somebody's life. This is just, you know, you're going before Congress to testify, for God's sake. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean, and here's the thing. We used to get angry when Bill Clinton wagged his finger and said, I did not have sex with that woman, Monica Lewinsky. And we knew he was lying, and later on he admitted that he lied to the American people. People were angry. We were also angry that he was a lawyer and he lied under oath to a federal judge. And that was wrong as well. And there was a lot of outrage. And I remember at the time the phrase my wife always reminds me of, perjury is perjury. Doesn't matter if it was for a good reason or a bad reason, perjury is perjury. And when you see a president who stood right there on that debate stage and Donald Trump called him out and said, you and your family have made millions of dollars in China, and Joe Biden explicitly said, I have made no money in China. My family has made no money in China. I have no involvement in my son's business affairs. And then we see pictures of Joe Biden and Hunter Biden's business associates. We see bank records. We see transfers of millions of dollars, some of which went to Joe Biden. The rest of it went to the rest of his family. And you realize this is a president who lied and peddled his influence to make money. We know that he stole classified documents, used some of them in a book, and he got paid $8 million in an advance for that book that he himself told the ghostwriter, this is classified documents. When you lie, if you lie about little things, you know, you, some guy calls you up, Stacey, and says, hey, you want to meet, or your friend calls up and says, you want to meet for dinner? And you say, oh, I'm really busy tonight. You know, and you're really not busy tonight. You just don't feel like going out to dinner. Okay, that's the kind of little, but when you lie about millions of dollars, you lie about classified documents, you lie about national security, and you lie during a presidential campaign and say, no, I've never made a dime from China, and neither has my family. And we find out you're a big, fat liar, big guy, then you deserve to be impeached. And if you had any sense of justice in your own heart, you'd submit your resignation today.
The Lars. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. This week, broadcasting live from Stanford University.
This university will no longer continue any funding of any kind for your group's activity.
Home to some of the greatest minds of our time. Phil Knight, Hewlett and Packard, the founders of Yahoo, PayPal, and even Lars's mom. Since Lars never graduated college, he's bringing some of the brightest minds on air so he can learn something.
Republicans, are you prepared to go into this fight?
Now, live from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University.
You can inspire their devotion to American ideals.
Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and we are live from the Hoover Broadcast Studios on the Stanford campus. We come here about once a year, and we get a chance to talk to some very smart people. But we have some very smart people elsewhere as well. And I thought I'd ask a few questions about a really major decision that came out in about the last 10 days or so. It involves the real estate industry in the United States, and it involved a massive decision, hundreds of millions of dollars, because allegedly the real estate business has not been conducting itself legitimately, and that they have been insisting on some kind of commission structure. Now, I've bought and sold houses, not myself. I mean, I've always had an agent to represent me, and in fact, Nick Shivers has been my agent. He's one of the great supporters of this program. He's got the real estate business he runs called the Nick Shivers Team, and we call on him when issues like this come up. Nick, welcome back.
Always a pleasure to be here, Lars.
Now, you took real exception because there was this major decision that the, well, at least in a couple of states, the real estate business was going to be fined hundreds of millions of dollars because allegedly real estate agents have engaged in fixing a fixed commission that must be paid on every house sale and every house purchase, and the secondary issue of how that commission gets split between the people representing the buyer of a house and the people representing the seller of a house, who pays it, how it gets split, and all of that. And you took a real exception to that. I wanted my audience to hear that.
Sure. So, Lars, on CNN, it said the fixed rate 6% commission is dead. Realtor settle. Number one, okay, that was not the settlement. It had nothing to do with commissions. So what it had to do with is what the Department of Justice said agents do. They steer. So if I now, effective July 1st, if me and you sit down, Lars, and I say, Lars, what kind of incentive do you want to give to the buyer and to buy your house, and you say, oh, let's just give them 2.5% commission, I can no longer put that in the public remarks for the MLS. So now a buyer agent and a buyer will no longer see what the listing agent or the seller is willing to pay them in order for them to buy their house. That is number one. Number two, there is no fixed rate commissions. I mean, they vary from FSBOs to $500, not unlike attorneys, CPAs, financial planners, where they all have different prices. And they always, my grandpappy said, Lars, cheap usually isn't good, and good usually isn't cheap.
But again, in fact, let me interject for a moment, because you used a term people may not know. FSBO means for sale by owner. It's a shorthand, and what it means is somebody has a house, and they say, I don't need an agent. I'll just go out and sell it on my own, which can work out okay. It can also be a train wreck, depending on how things go, and you worry that maybe somebody's going to forget to cross a T or dot an I in cases like that. But But you're right. If somebody says, no, I'm not paying six, I'm only willing to pay four, that can happen, right?
It's been happening. I've been in this game for 26 years, Lars, and the varied commissions are exactly like the type of houses we sell and our and the clients that we serve. Understand, and data backs this up, the United States residential real estate market is the most efficient and cost-effective system in the world. They keep referencing United Kingdom, Europe, and stuff like that. Let's look at the numbers, okay? Because, you know, fake news is everywhere, Lars. We got to get to the fact. 69 yep. days on average in the U.S. United Kingdom, 183 days.
So okay? In other words, in the U.S., if you put your house on the market from top to bottom, the average is a little over 2 months to sell your house. In Great Britain, it's basically 6 months as the average, which means if the average is six, it could take 9 months or a year.
Right. Here's the other little news thing. Inflated commissions are causing home prices to be unaffordable. Okay, let's look at that issue. United Kingdom, they say that commissions, real estate commissions, are 2-3%. Well, number one, that's not completely true because now there's a thing called concessions that a buyer agent can ask the seller to pay for. So they're probably the same. But if we look at the price per square foot in the United States compared to the poster child that they keep talking about, the United Kingdom, we're at $221 a square foot, and they're at $332 a square foot.
More than 50% more.
Yes. So, the biggest question, when this just came out, Lars, the biggest buyer of single-family homes, they buy them and they keep them for rentals, is Blackstone. And what Blackstone's president...
Or Blackstone or BlackRock?
BlackRock, excuse me.
BlackRock, yeah.
And his statement was, now is the time for investors to pounce. Why would that be? Well, if you get rid of a trusted advisor that not only will know what the open market value of your home is and what these hedge fund Wall Street guys will give you, you can make an informed decision. These guys don't give you what you can get on the open market. They'll give you what they will give you for the price of the home. So it's very interesting to me. The most efficient residential real estate system in the world is under attack. And I don't think it's from home sellers that have made hundreds of thousands. 85% of Americans, their biggest asset is their home.
Is their house. Yep.
We want that to continue, Lars. We want.
Now, are you telling me that BlackRock and these other players that have been buying large amounts of residential real estate, clearly, if they're buying it, they think it's worth or will be worth the money they're paying for it. They're saying now's the time to pounce because of this decision that now makes it much less transparent. I mean, that's the way I read your comments, that if you're saying you can no longer tell somebody who's coming to buy your house with their representative, if they're represented by somebody, the seller is going to pay 2.5 or 3% of your buyer agent's fee. If you don't tell that to people, how are they going to find out?
Well, it's just like the commercial market here in the United States right now. So what's going to happen is I'm going to call the listing agent and say, hey, and it's all about negotiations. Now, me and my team, we have great negotiators. I don't have a problem with that. It's just I believe the platform that it was before was way more transparent than it's going to be now. It's going to be kind of like the Wild Wild West. You better know whoever's representing you is an incredible negotiator because there's going to be a lot more going on.
And what you could do is you could walk into any agent and say, I know the standard amount, the usual amount is 6%. I want to pay four. I think my house is going to go fast, not going to take a lot of your time. I want to pay four. And you can negotiate that as a seller, can't you?
Yeah, and Lars, it comes back, you know, the government keeps saying, you know, this, that, we need affordable housing. It comes to supply and demand. If you look, when supply is low and demand is high, builders, big tract builders that are selling hundreds and hundreds of homes, give a lower commission. When supply is high and demand is kind of where it is right now, guess what? They get bonuses. They get $10,000 bonuses here and there.
Absolutely right. That's Nick Shivers, one of the supporters of this program, and his real estate business, the Nick Shivers team. We'll be back in a moment. I want to get to your phone calls and emails. And apparently the newest member of the Supreme Court thinks the First Amendment hamstrings the government.
Lots of folks worry about their firearms, but Lars doesn't have to worry about Biden taking his guns. He stores them upstairs. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Big Iron Otis here.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday, and we're broadcasting live from the Hoover Studios on Stanford University campus at Hoover Institution. I got to tell you something. We are talking to some great people, and I hope you stick around for those. But I want to talk a bit about Ketanji Brown Jackson. I'll get to that after I take a couple of calls. But this woman who was put on the U.S. Supreme Court by Joe Biden, Ketanji Brown Jackson doesn't seem to know the first thing. And if you say, well, Lars, we figured that out when she was in that confirmation hearing and she was asked, what is a woman? She said, well, I'm not a biologist, says this woman, so I can't tell you what a woman is and what a woman isn't. Now, obviously, she was trying to tailor her remarks so as not to anger the LGBTQ crowd, but it made her sound as dumb as a bag of hammers. Well, she's done that one better, and I'll tell you about it in just a moment. First, to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Hey, Ron in Tacoma, what's on your mind, and welcome to the program.
Well, I had a very interesting phone call in the last 30 minutes with Senator Catherine Cortez Mastro in Las Vegas.
Oh, really?
So you called a public official
in Las Vegas. What did you want to find out?
Well, I was concerned because I've seen some of the videos over the last 48 hours of racial beatdowns, white people getting beat down on the Strip. And it concerned me for a minute. And here's the deal. After a five-minute conversation with them, I got nowhere. She basically, I asked her point blank. I said, are you aware of this? She said she didn't know nothing about it. I said, I'm concerned for my family's safety. I'd like to know if anything's being done about this. She immediately hung up on me after I expressed concern for my family's safety coming there for an event that's in 2 weeks.
You know, you'd think that a public official like that would want to reassure you, no, it's a safe place, if it is, and the fact that she's not aware of some of these incidents that are apparently happening out in front of, you know, God and everybody enough that they end up on video and posted online, that's a smart thing to ask about. What do you think about her response?
I think that I'm trying to cancel my flight, and I won't be attending the Rockability car show, and I'm going to call the car show and tell them exactly what occurred.
I got to tell you something. I used to think of Vegas always as a relatively safe place, most of the time because most of the casinos don't put up with a lot of nonsense. They decide to take care of problems right away, and I've always admired that they would do that. Let me go to Anthony. Hey, Anthony, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Yo, Lars, good to see you again, and I love your show.
Thank you.
No problem. My question is, you know how we have the SO registry, correct?
The sex offender registry, yep.
Why do we not have a violence registry and a drug dealing registry?
Who would you put in it? In other words, when it's violence, do you mean you'd only put murderers, or you'd put murderers and attempted murderers, or would you put people in who've committed assault? Because that goes the whole range. I mean, some assaults are very, very serious, and some are very, very minor. Who would you put in?
That's the same with the SO registry. You can have people that pee in public, and they could get on that registry.
Yeah, I'm not sure that would work out so well, because the range of things you could do, I mean, let's say domestic violence, which usually we think of as men and women, husbands and wives, boyfriends and girlfriends, but sometimes domestic violence can be two brothers who get in a fight about the Super Bowl, and one punches the other one in the nose, and all of a sudden you've got a domestic violence charge. Would you put all of those people in a registry, and then how many people would you have in that kind of registry? And would you simply tar all of those people by putting their names on a list? Let me get back to Ketanji Brown Jackson. Now, I've never thought much about her. I looked at her background when she came up for confirmation to the U.S. Supreme Court. I wasn't impressed. I was less impressed when I saw that when she tried to answer questions, like having a member of Congress say, what is a woman? Judge Jackson. And she said, well, I'm not a biologist, so I can't tell you what a woman is. That was crazy enough. But this week came a new low for Ketanji Brown Jackson on the U.S. Supreme Court. She is worried about the First Amendment. And you know what her worry is? I'll use her words. She is worried that the First Amendment will, quote, hamstring the government in significant ways in the most important time periods. Well, I don't know. Maybe this is news to Ketanji Brown Jackson. Maybe she missed that day in law school when they taught about the First Amendment. But that's exactly what the First Amendment is supposed to do. It's supposed to hamstring the government. In other words, if you want to engage in free speech, there are a few things where you can go too far. For example, and I'll give the examples of where the government can regulate your free speech. One, if you threaten any kind of harm to an American president, the vice president, members of their family, other significant people in the federal government, that's actually in the U.S. Code. It is a crime. I would imagine that if somebody ever wanted to test the constitutionality of that, they might actually be able to prove that it violates the First Amendment. But I think most people are okay with a law that says you can't threaten the president, the vice president, members of their family, etc. You can also have something called inciting to riot. You cannot, as I think Al Sharpton has done in his history, stand in front of a crowd and encourage them to burn down a neighborhood, say a neighborhood in New York City. That's inciting to riot. You're not allowed to do that. But you have to take some rather extreme measures to make that happen. You've had Donald Trump, who's been accused left and right of insurrection, even though there's absolutely no evidence that he was involved in an attempted takeover of the United States government. You could have things like that that would fall into the category of free speech. But other than that, the First Amendment is designed to hamstring the government. Your free speech rights do not come to you because of that document. You have them as your inalienable, God-given rights to free expression and free speech and freedom of the press. But, you know, this justice, Justice Jackson, says, so can you help me? Because I'm really worried that about that, meaning the First Amendment, because you've got the First Amendment operating in an environment of threatening circumstance from the government's perspective. Hold on a second. Am I worried about the government's perspective on this? If the government says to you, you told a lie, well, that's my business, isn't it? I mean, unless you're lying to a federal official, like an FBI agent or U.S. Marshal, you're allowed to lie. And in fact, it's a constitutionally protected right of free speech. But she apparently believes that when the government believes that you're saying things that the government finds inconvenient, that the government should be able to shut you down. Now, what they're arguing about is a case in which the government went to social media companies and said, we want you to shut down some of the free speech of Americans. And this case called Murthy v. Missouri. Ketanji Brown Jackson apparently thinks it would be more convenient if the government was allowed to simply shut down free speech when, from the government's perspective, they find it problematic. For example, in that case, things that have come up, anything that promotes vaccine hesitancy, the government didn't like. If you went out and said, I don't believe in masking up during the pandemic, I don't believe in closing businesses down, I don't believe in closing schools, well, the government says, we find that problematic, and so we'd like to be able to shut it down. And apparently, Ketanji Brown Jackson believes that the protection of your God-given First Amendment freedoms of free speech is inconvenient and that it hamstrings the government. Ketanji Brown Jackson, that's exactly what it was designed to do, and I hope it always does. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
The 40th President of the United States always knew where to put the blame.
You have blamed mistakes of the past, and you blame the Congress. Does any of the blame belong to you?
Yes, because for many years I was a Democrat.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you live from the broadcast studios at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. And we come here to talk to the smartest people in the world. And one of them is standing in the studio with me, Michael Bernstam, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford with expertise in internationally economics, the former Soviet Union, and Russian politics. Professor, it's good to see you.
Oh, thank you to be here.
Step right up to that microphone. I want you to be close enough for everybody to hear you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, let's get right into this, is saying that Ukraine's survival is very much in danger and there isn't some other way to resolve this conflict. You and I have talked about Ukraine a lot in the last couple of years that this has been going on. Where do we appear to be headed, and is there any kind of resolution to this?
Oh, things have changed in the last few days. Probably they changed before, but we can notice only recently. Russia had the presidential elections, and immediately they are starting to talk, not in those very words, but between the lines, about freezing the conflict. They are talking about building up, quote-unquote, buffer zones between Ukraine and Russia, which means that both sides are exhausted. It's very hard to continue this war. It's 750 days. They lack financial resources. They lack human resources. They don't more, for better or worse, they don't have more people to kill, to be killed. And so they are still attacking. Russia is attacking Ukraine, killing people. They sent missiles. Ukraine found a very cost-effective way now. Ukraine found drones. You buy a drone for a few hundred dollars, and they blow up oil refineries in Russia all over the place. And now Russian oil production is down by 9.5%. Mm-hmm. And Russia cannot sell its liquid petroleum products, so they're selling crude oil, which is cheaper, and this is a bad experience for Russia. So both sides are now looking for a way out, and probably, you see, the problem with Russia is that, that's not just Russia, every dictator, any dictator, they cannot be losers. A dictator cannot afford to be a failure. He cannot afford to be a loser because they will lose grip on the domestic politics. And so after the presidential elections, they couldn't do it before, they are probably ready to strike a deal.
Strike a deal because Putin has six more years in office after this, after the election.
And the war is going nowhere. He is not winning. And so now, probably, they may just want to freeze the conflict. It is not armistice because they are still shooting at each other. But they may freeze the conflict and it will be like the 38th parallel in Korea.
I was going to ask you whether or not that was the model, because officially the war in Korea has never ended, has it?
The war officially never ended. And by the way, not just Korea. Take Germany. Germany was divided. Austria was divided by the Soviet Union left on its own in 1955. But generally, we have lots of frozen conflicts in the world. Look at the map. Cyprus. That's the model.
And so, is that a workable solution to this? Freeze it, put some buffers in, and have everybody at some point stop shooting.
It is not acceptable at the moment to either side because Ukraine wants its lands and people back. Russia wants more because they included in their constitution more land of Ukraine than they actually control. But nonetheless, there is an opportunity for some kind of an understanding at which neither side can continue.
Now, you know that, Professor, from the beginning, I've been saying, where is America's national interest? Why are we funding this? This is coming, at least in part, tell me if I'm wrong, it's coming in part because more funding from the U.S., which Zelensky keeps asking for, Joe Biden keeps arguing in favor of sending more funding, but the funding isn't coming, and there doesn't appear to be a willingness on the part of the Congress to send more, and there's only so much Biden can say send on his own say-so, and the funding has slowed down or stopped, and Europe is not stepping up to fill the gap. Is it because if the money's run out, along with the human capital, you've got to come to some kind of solution?
The United States and the European Union promised more than they could deliver. But no one expected that war to continue as long. And so recently the European Union allocated, after a long political battle between the members, allocated 50 billion euros. What they didn't say, which is kind of a small footnote, they have only 17 of 50. 33 billion they have to issue the debt for the next 4 years.
To borrow it?
To borrow it from somewhere they don't know where. And now what they're trying to do is to collect 3 to 4 billion euros of windfall profits because interest rates are high. So they want to get windfall profits from frozen Russian funds and give it to Ukraine, $3 to $4 billion instead of 33 and instead of 50 that they promised.
If
the United States promised over $100 billion, delivered 43, now 60.6 are blocked in the United States Congress, so there is the financial aid is dwindling down.
Okay, so, and one of the questions is a side question. You mentioned another side question, but the side question is, if you take the European Union as a whole, its economy is about as big as the United States, and yet it seems as though the United States has put far more into this European war than the rest of Europe has put into this war. Is that a fair comparison?
Actually, the European Union economy and the United States economy are about equal. 27 trillion dollars at the latest count, but at the moment, at the final count, the Europeans put more money because they, they delivered more. But now both are in this financial crisis. The problem is that all these economies are heavily indebted.
Yep.
It's very, very hard to raise more funds, and they want to issue more debt. The United States is talking about some additional measures to circumvent this constraint, but generally, no one expected this war to last so long.
Well, and I can't imagine the Europeans are any more enthusiastic about more borrowing than conservatives are in this country. I mean, Joe Biden doesn't seem to mind proposing spending $7.3 trillion while only taking in $5.5 trillion. So we're overspending our income nationally at the federal government level by like $1.8 trillion. I'll bet the Europeans don't like the idea of borrowing more either, do they?
No, that's the problem is that now it's a major article of the budget of the United States just servicing the debt.
Yep.
The United States has $34 trillion in debt. So this is larger than GDP, and we have problems with Social Security Trust Fund, with Medicare Trust Fund. So this is a problem. But again, this war is a very expensive business.
Yeah, it is. And Biden you would think that Biden would see this as a lifeboat, a life ring for him to say we could have the war end, go to some kind of stalemate between the two, set up the buffer zones, and not have to send more tens of billions of dollars.
The problem which concerns everyone, myself included, but all the governments, and they should be concerned about it, is a simple question of the Cold War and of all this kind of conflicts. If we reach some kind of balance and temporary equilibrium, is it stable? Who will break it tomorrow? So the question is, if you find a deal, make sure that it holds.
Yeah. And do we bear any responsibility now that we know we had secret CIA bases right on Russia's border?
Well, we have lots of bases all over the world, and Russia now is building bases in Africa and elsewhere, so Russia is also intent on expansion. But the problem is, how do you make a stable relations, and the world is very unstable now, and we have 6,000 nuclear weapons in Russia, and almost as many here.
Professor Bernstam, thank you very much. I appreciate your insights. That's Michael Bernstam, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution here at Stanford University. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Was wrong about a lot of things, but he's right about this.
People have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
What say you, Joe Biden? This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. We're live all this week at the Stanford University campus. I want to get some of your phone calls right now, but if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And this segment of the show is brought to you by 540training.com, concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense online at 540training.com. That's 540training.com. Our poll on X today, we come up with a new question. My producer producers and I. And today, Peter Navarro, who was one of Donald Trump's most steadfast employees and staff at the White House for 4 years, went to federal prison this week. He will be there for 4 months. And what was his great and horrible crime? The Congress subpoenaed him to testify, and he said, I'm not coming down there to answer questions from you, or words to that effect. Should Hunter Biden, who also defied a congressional subpoena, should Hunter Biden also go to federal prison? I would answer that one yes. You can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let me go to Gary in the Tri-Cities, listening on the Radio Northwest Network and a great radio station, KONA. Gary, what's on your mind today?
Yes, Lars, what I'd like to do is suggest a new term for the Republican Party while they campaign, and it's the, what I would call it, Biden's compound inflation.
Okay, and right, compound now, in what sense?
Each month you add up on, so each month's a cumulative. Like right now, they're showing charts and everything, like one time it'll be 9%, 6%, and it's going down like about 4, on 3 right now. But yep. In reality, the inflation is still going up.
Yep.
Just like compound interest, it's cumulative.
It is, and because, so, Gary, if you think about it this way, and I'll back up your point, right now, in round numbers, consumer goods are up just over 20%. It might even be as high as 22, but take the conservative figure, 20. So what cost you $100 3 years ago in Joe Bidenomics is now costing you $120. So even if we brought inflation down to, say, 2%, we ran at 2% inflation for the better part of 20 years, you know, with some notable exceptions like 2008 when the economy fell off a cliff. But it was about 2% a year. So ordinarily, if you spent $100 on something today, then at the same time next year, it'd be $102, except that
correct.
With compound inflation, if it's now $120 to buy $100 worth of goods, then next year it'll be 3% or 2% higher than 120. You're right. It does compound in that way.
Yeah, but what I want the party to do is every time they make a chart, they'll show the monthly rate, let's say 3%, but
yep.
You go back to Bart when Biden first became in the election and make it zero inflation at that point in time.
Yep.
And every time you show the monthly, you show the compound. So 1 month is 33%, the next thing is 6% or 3%. The compound would show it's 6+%.
Well,
it keeps growing.
But it's year over year, not month over month. So when they talk about inflation figures of now 3.5%, that's 3.5% per year.
No, I disagree. The
you
inflation
disagree.
Is each month.
Well, yes, there is
they
a monthly
the inflation. They have inflation for that month.
Gary, they do, but what...
But they look, also show year for year, but you don't have to do that. See, I used to be an auditor for the government. In fact, I was down at Stanford twice as a defense contract auditor. So, and I was involved with...
Gary, I understand that, but the figure we're using, say 3.5%, which is about where inflation is right now, that's an annual
true.
Figure. So it's about 0.3% per month times 12 months is 3.5%.
No, that's not. That's the inflation for that month.
3.5% per month.
Number.
No,
yes.
but Gary, if that were true, then
yes.
Something that cost you $100 on January 1 of this year would cost you $103 on February 1, $106 on March 1, $109 on April 1. That's not a monthly inflation figure. That's an annual figure. The monthly, they always state it as an annual figure because the smaller numbers don't make sense. You know, because it is an annual figure. It would mean over 12.
Regardless.
If you were, Gary, if you were right.
We don't need it. We don't discuss that because
there still
is a cumulative
yes,
compound
there is.
Inflation from the day Biden took office.
Do you know what I think is the better way to compare it, Gary? I go back and I look at what was the average inflation for the 4 years of Donald Trump. It was 1.9% per year. On the day Joe Biden took office, inflation was actually running at 1.7. So that was an annual figure. What is it running at now? Twice as high. So in other words, prices are rising twice as high in Joe Biden's America today as they were on the day he took office. Prices are going up twice as fast.
We're letting Biden off the hook if we just use the monthly annual inflation that they use. We should always show a cumulative because it's still
going
up.
And that's fine. If it's and it is compounding, but it's compounding not at a 3.5% per month rate. If it were, it would mean that whatever you bought for $100 today, 12 months from now, would cost you $136 or 36% more if inflation was running at 3.5% per month. Gary, thanks very much. I appreciate the call. We're live at the Stanford University campus in the Hoover Broadcast Studios, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Lars Larson Show. This week, broadcasting live from Stanford University.
This university will no longer continue any funding of any kind for your group's activity.
Home to some of the greatest minds of our time. Phil Knight, Hewlett and Packard, the founders of Yahoo, PayPal, and even Lars's mom. Since Lars never graduated college, he's bringing some of the brightest minds on air so he can learn something.
Republicans, are you prepared to go into this fight?
Now, live from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University.
You can inspire their devotion to American ideals.
Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I got a question for you just to get you started. When most murderers in a particular area end up with their final conviction cut down to just manslaughter, when a murder conviction might put them away for 25 years and then some, and all of a sudden, now we've cut a deal, you're going to get manslaughter instead. It's going to be a much shorter term. Do you consider that to be real justice? Well, I thought I'd put that question to Darren Campbell. He's with Radio Cab. He's their director of marketing, media, and government affairs. And Darren wrote to me. He said, Lars, I was the guy in that story that was done by the ABC affiliate, KATU, regarding murder pleas and the fact that it seems the vast majority of murder cases by the very liberal district attorney of Multnomah County end up being pled down to a much lower charge. Darren, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lars. Appreciate it.
My audience has heard my point of view on this, but I want to hear your point of view, and I want them to hear it as well. Is there justice in that kind of plea?
We don't think so. We think that, first I really want to say that I wouldn't be on the air with you right now if it wasn't for a very important person in this, and that's Reese Lahan.
Yep.
Who had his life taken, for absolutely no purpose. And this was an individual who was a benefit to society. If this person would have said, I'm having a crisis, he would have bent over backwards to help him.
And the person you're talking about is this Moses Lopez who murdered Reese Lahan.
Yes, that's exactly who I'm talking about. And you know, the plea deal itself is troubling. Some of the things that weren't reported, this person was in custody 5 days prior in Coos County for unlawful use of a weapon and menacing. And was released because of some new pre-sentencing custody guidelines that were passed by the legislature in 2021. And they were in custody because they couldn't fulfill their desire to purchase a gun at a Bi-Mart store. I really believe that Moses Lopez was out to kill somebody. And our system failed Reese Lahan.
And by the way, fill in this blank. What do we know about what happened that led up to the murder of Reese Lahan and why Moses Lopez did it? Because it's one of the usual questions I would ask in any kind of crime of violence is, was there any reason as to why this happened? What do you know?
Without a trial, Lars, we will never know. Unless Moses decides to come out and give a reason, we just don't know. And that's one of the frustrating points of this whole thing. It just seemed like somebody that was not liked by society in their point of view, and we're going to take it out on somebody, and Reese happened to be that person.
Because one of the perspectives I've got, Darren, is that I constantly have people say, I don't like plea deals. And I say, well, I know you don't like plea deals, but 90%+ of criminal cases are resolved through plea deals. And there's a good there are good reasons for the victims in many cases, because if the prosecutor figures I have a weak case, we could end up with one juror, and one juror means a killer or somebody who's committed a horrible crime of some other kind other than murder could simply walk out the door. So plea deals give you certainty, but usually the DA is only given an incentive to take a plea from a defendant if they have a weak case, or if there's a great concern that this person is simply going to walk away with no punishment whatsoever. So there are pluses to plea deals, but the minuses are that the victims don't get real justice when the DA seems to bend over backwards for a huge number of cases. According to K2's investigation, it seems the majority of murder cases are simply dealt with in Multnomah County through plea deals that take it from murder, 25 years mandatory minimum, and it could be greater than that, all the way down to maybe half of that.
Yeah, and I will tell you, the family, I think, got some benefit from this plea deal, being that they didn't have to travel back and forth. They have aging parents. It would have been difficult. But I think that the DA could have gotten so much more. I was one of the very unlucky people that had the opportunity to see the evidence. I saw the video. The video leaves absolutely nothing left for the imagination to fill in. The demonic look on Moses Lopez's face as he plunged that knife into Reese's neck was bone-chilling, and I cannot imagine any jury anywhere not getting a conviction on the murder two charge and putting him away for life. It was 25 years to life is what murder two would have been.
Do you think there was some other agenda at work?
We're going to get.
Do you think, I'm sorry, Darren, but do you think there's any other agenda at work at the DA's office that made them go this direction with it? Say an agenda of, racial justice. We've heard a lot about that from Mike Schmidt. I don't have much respect for the district attorney. And in this case, that he took a murder committed on video, which, as you point out, the jury would have seen as evidence, and decided to just throw away what seems like a pretty solid case.
Well, the only thing that was brought up by the district attorney's office, and I am hearing this secondhand through the family, is that they were concerned about the possibility of having somebody from the transgender community ending up on the jury and having sympathy for their situation. And I have no doubt that they would have played the transgender card to the fullest in the defense, because that's all they had. That was a concern, but I have to go back to the video and say, I don't care who you are, you can't accept that person into your community if they're acting like that, and if you do, then you're part of the problem.
I agree with you, and frankly, that comes down to judges, because if you were a judge is supposed to be a neutral third party, would you say, yes, Moses Lopez and transgender issues, that's part of the question here? I don't think it's part of the question. The question isn't, what gender did you think you were? What pronoun do you go by? The question was, did you plunge a knife into the neck of this man? That's the relevant question. I'm not sure a jury should have even heard about whatever, peculiarities the defendant had.
Yeah, I agree with you. I do have a question, though, and maybe this is something you can push towards Josh Marquis. He's the one that would probably know the answer to this. When we first heard that the plea deal had been made and heard that we were looking at 19 to 22 years, the first thing I thought of was those cases in Coos County. Can we get Paul Frazier, the Coos County DA, to prosecute on those charges? There's three felonies, each with a maximum of 5 years. Maybe we can get more time out of that. So I called Paul Frazier, and I will tell you, Paul Frazier and Gabe Fabrizio, the Coos County Sheriff, great people. They responded to every request I had. Terrific people.
Yeah.
They were called by the Multnomah County District Attorney, and them not pursuing charges was added into this plea deal. I've never heard of one county reaching out to another county as part of a plea deal to not prosecute on cases.
I haven't either. Have you ever heard of that?
I've never heard of that. I'm going to put that in front of Josh, as you suggest. That's Darren Campbell. Darren is with Radio Cab. Reese Lahan was an employee of Radio Cab, worked with Radio Cab. He's the man who was murdered by Moses Lopez, except Lopez walks on a lesser sentence for manslaughter only. Is that justice? Coming up, we'll talk about elections and... The Line.
Gun Control Explained.
Want to stop drunk drivers from killing sober drivers? Ban sober drivers. That's how gun control works.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. We're live in the broadcast studios of the Hoover Institution on the Stanford campus. I want to talk to you about something called ERIC. And I want to explain to you what it is, because I find that most people who care a lot about America's election system, and we have a system, it's spelled out in the Constitution, it's spelled out in the laws of all 50 states. But if you think that only government is involved, there's a very significant player, and it's called ERIC, the Electronic Registration Information System. In fact, it has the kind of name that might even lead you to believe, well, that must be a state or federal government agency, and you'd be exactly wrong. It is not. It is a private organization, and the ties it has to the liberal left in America would make you blanch. And I'm going to tell you all about them in a moment. But first, welcome to the program. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, you're always welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our X poll. Today's X poll has to do with Peter Navarro, who went to federal prison this week. He will sit in federal prison for at least 4 months before he's allowed out. The horrible crime that he's supposed to have committed is that when the U.S. Congress said to Peter Navarro, one of the most steadfast employees in Donald Trump's White House, Peter Navarro said, "I'm not complying with the subpoena." Now, there have been plenty of other people on the left who refused to comply with congressional subpoenas, among them former Attorney General Eric Holder. You've got Hunter Biden. You've got many people. But on the left, if you tell Congress to pound sand, we're not going to talk to you, nothing much happens. Hunter Biden has openly defied a congressional subpoena to testify about the crimes of the Biden crime family, and he gets no punishment at all. But if you're associated with Donald Trump, like Peter Navarro, you end up going to federal prison for 4 months. Now, I don't think that's right. I think having a double standard of justice is wrong. So that's the question you'll find at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll also find it on our website at LarsLarson.com. But I want you to know about ERIC, because the Electronic Registration Information System is a private group funded by, almost exclusively funded by, liberal leftists. And you say, so we've trusted them with all the election records of American voters? Well, not all of them. A number of states have already said, we are quitting this group. We don't want to have anything to do with it. And the latest that's headed that direction is the state of Virginia. And let me tell you what happened in Virginia that was so telling about what ERIC actually represents. A report from the Public Interest Legal Foundation about ERIC's zeal to target for voter registration tens of thousands of ineligible individuals, including dead people. They call them eligible but unregistered. And Governor Glenn Youngkin of Virginia has said, look, we don't want to have anything to do with ERIC. And as I said, a number of states have already quit this electronic registration information system because it's gamed in favor of the liberals and the Democrats. So what did they find in this Public Interest Legal Foundation report? That Virginia elections officials had to go in and find 168,000 people that ERIC had ordered the state go out and find a way to register these people to vote. And of those, about 100,000 dead people and about 68,000 people who no longer even live in the state of Virginia. Now, remember, the U.S. Constitution says how elections are to be laid out and conducted. And what it says is all the states, at this point 50 states, are to decide how elections are to be run in their states, which means the rules are different in all 50 states. They're similar, but there are significant differences between various states. So you say, well, they go in and clean up the voter rolls, right? You would take people out who are dead. You would take people out who've moved. You would take people out if they turn out to not be citizens of the United States. You'd take all those people off the rolls. In theory, that is what ERIC, the Electronic Registration Information Center, is supposed to do. It does not do that. It works very, very hard to sign people up to vote, and it works almost equally hard to make sure that you don't take those people off the voting rolls, even if they don't vote, even if they're not alive, even if they don't live in the state. Now, what's happened? More troubling, this is from the Federalist. Records from other ERIC member states obtained by the Public Interest Legal Foundation show similar efforts. ERIC requires members to submit voter registration and driver's license data to its central database. The nonprofit then searches for licensed drivers who have not registered to vote. They call them eligible but unregistered, EBU. And that's the way ERIC talks about them. So what do they want you to do? They want you to go out and sign people up to vote. Now, there are people who say, I don't want to register to vote. I have no interest in voting. Now, I'm registered to vote. I'm proud to cast a ballot, and I understand the flaws in the system. But if you don't want to be registered, why would you go out of the way to try to sign people up to vote? And why in the world would you want to keep people on the voter rolls who are actually dead or who have moved out of state or who are not citizens of the United States and thus not eligible to register? So in what this report from the Federalist shows, in the months before the 2020 election, Virginia's Democrat-appointed elections commissioner at the time agreed to send out more than 2 million voter registration reminder postcards to these EBUs. Now, that's even though everybody who gets a driver's license, everybody who gets a state identification card under the Motor Voter Act, which is a federal law, says you have to offer the person the chance to sign up to vote. So all those people have already been offered a chance to sign up to vote. They have decided not to. Virginia agreed to turn over voter registration and turnout data to the EBUs, turn it over to another private group called CEIR. And what is CEIR? The Center for Election Innovation and Research. The outfit that got $70 million in 2020 from Mark Zuckerberg and his very political wife, Priscilla Chan. So in other words, in 2017, CEIR had almost no money at all. And then in 2018, they get $70 million from Mark Zuckerberg and his wife. What does that do? That means CEIR, which is run, according to the Federalist, a guy by the name of David Becker. He's an election law attorney. He is former head of People for the American Way, which is a lefty activist group. He served in the voting rights section of the Justice Department Civil Rights Division in the early 2000s. And when he left, what did the former head of the federal agency he worked for say? They said Becker was a hardcore leftist who, quote, could not stand conservatives and should have been disbarred from the legal profession for unethical behavior. And he's running this outfit that's getting all this voter data. He's going to use it to benefit the Democrat Party, to hurt the Republican Party. This is a way to game the system. It's cheating that will be very, very hard to see. Elections officials have now found and removed 11,000 declared non-citizens from Virginia's voting rolls since 2014. In other words, they'd already signed people up to vote who are not American citizens. And just 2 years ago, Colorado sent out voter registration cards to 30,000 people who are not citizens. The game is being rigged. And when people tell you you can trust the election system, don't believe it. We're not there yet. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Y'all think it takes balls is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and we're live from the broadcast studios of the Hoover Institution on the Stanford University campus. It's one of the reasons we come here every year, to make sure I get a chance to talk to some of the smartest people in the world. And one of the things I want to talk to this guest about is the fact that for the longest time, you hear people argue about the environment, and you hear many of the arguments against some of the environmental rules that are imposed by others, federal government, state government, and the rest, are argued against because they're not good for the economy. But that doesn't always have to be true. In fact, being pro-environment can be tied up very nicely with economic prosperity. And the man who knows that best is Terry Anderson, who is the John and Jean Denault Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. Mr. Anderson, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be on, and pleasure to be with you again.
You've been here a long time, and we're both former residents of Montana, so good on you for that.
Well, thank you. It's a great place to live, but it's kind of nice to escape once in a while to Hoover and Stanford.
Absolutely, and you head up the Property and Environment Research Center in Bozeman, and that sounds good to me, because you can have private property, you can have economic prosperity, and safeguard the environment, correct?
Correct. In fact, I built most of my career, and I would guess the main reason I'm a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution is the work I did on what has come to be known as free market environmentalism. As that title suggests, markets and the environment can go together. They aren't at loggerheads with one another, need not be. And if it's profitable, it's sustainable.
The thing I worry about, Professor, is when the government says, well, we're going to make it profitable by simply allowing, you know, not denying people the ability to do things that are in their best economic interest, and say, your only choice is over here. I mean, I would use light bulbs as an example of that, where they say, we didn't ban incandescent bulbs. We only set standards that made it impossible for incandescent bulbs to meet the standard, and therefore you're left with the choice of only buying fluorescents. Now, that's an example where I think mandates by the government are simply pushing people in a particular direction rather than the marketplace, which says, hey, we've got a better kind of mousetrap. You'll probably want to buy this one because it's much better than the one you're buying right now.
Well, you've hit on an essential part of free market environmentalism, and you use two words that fit in the title of a new project we have going at the Hoover Institution: markets versus mandates for the environment and economic prosperity. And that project is all about how markets can provide environmental quality, provide environmental services, and when they can't, how we can use governmental mandates, not all the time, but when necessary, to improve the way we deliver the environmental services that all of us, especially in the United States, are wealthy enough to demand.
Well, and in fact, I guess the only question I have is, how do you hold a government back from saying, hey, we want to speed this process up, so let's just make it so economically difficult for people to do other than what we want them to do, and we'll push them into it, versus the marketplace producing a better product that people want to buy for all the reasons that marketplaces influence people? How do you hold the government back from that?
I think the place to start is to demonstrate how markets can and are working to solve environmental problems. The project at Hoover, Markets versus Mandates, has a significant component of it devoted to focusing on ways in which markets have helped with water conservation, with wildlife conservation, with energy transitions, and even are helping people adapt to climate change. And I think by providing those examples, we at least set a tone for and a standard by which governmental regulators, mandators, must adhere. So I think that's the first step. I think the second step is to provide a way of understanding why mandates may be necessary in some cases, and just how difficult it is to make those mandates work, and a case in point is climate change.
Well, give me an example, would you mind, Professor Anderson? I'm talking to Terry Anderson, who's here at the Hoover Institution. What's an example where you think the government should tell us what to do?
When we think about, let me focus on energy. I think it's
sure.
a useful starting point. And if we focus on energy, markets are pretty good at the production side. Markets have a way of signaling what can be produced at a profitable price, and have done a good job with transitions. Just think back, not that you and I lived this era, but if we look back at the transition from horses to tractors, that was all about markets. It was about the marketplace developing the internal combustion engine, applying it to these implements that could pull a plow through the field and do it more cheaply than horses, which had to be fed and housed. And so the markets provided that transition. And I think it's important to understand that the production side is very much one that markets can handle. Back to your light bulb case.
Sure.
If consumers really are paying the full price of electricity, and they don't always because we like to subsidize everything for consumers, the government does. So if markets are providing the full price, people will start to say, gee, maybe I should find a more efficient light bulb. And that more efficient light bulb will be provided by the marketplace. But there are other cases where mandates are necessary. And when you think of CO2 emissions that immediately upon entry into the atmosphere, they are distributed all across the globe. They don't distinguish between the property line between Montana and Wyoming or the United States and Canada. And because of that, widespread distribution of the effects of my starting my diesel truck, there's a role for government to set standards, in some case put limits on just how much CO2 can be emitted. But it doesn't have to determine just exactly how that will be accomplished. And here I just can't resist the case in point. California's mandate, for electric cars, and the great subsidies that have gone into electric cars, and yet the resistance that exists from consumers who understand these are not economically feasible, they are very expensive, and we can do very well with improving the efficiency and CO2 emission standards through a market.
Well, should we, though, as the Biden administration today imposed what they called the strictest vehicle emission regs ever enacted to push the car industry toward electrics, should the federal government be forcing people saying, look, you're not going to have any choice. You're going to have to buy an electric because we're not going to let the industry make anything else?
I called my truck dealership in Montana to see whether I was going to be told I must drive an electric truck to pull my four-horse trailer when
Good
I
luck.
Want to move my horses from one place to the other. I was assured by the dealer that wasn't going to happen. But it illustrates just why a mandate for having electric cars won't work everywhere at all times. In California, you just can't drive down the street without seeing an electric car, especially a Tesla. Why? Because they're mandated and because they're subsidized and because they can work for short distance commuting. But you get to a place like Montana where it's cold and the distances are large and the capacity required for vehicles is large, they aren't welcomed by consumers.
No, they're not going to work out at well. Professor Anderson, thank you very much. That's Terry Anderson from the Hoover Institution. We're live at Hoover, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
He may talk about serious issues, but even Lars has a sense of humor.
I have a joke for you. The government in this town is excellent and uses your tax dollars efficiently.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. We're live on the Stanford campus all this week, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails. I did want to raise one issue for you, and it's a very small issue. It's in a part of Portland, and there are a bunch of neighbors, and they're very unhappy that there is a massive amount of trash and garbage, and it's all next to the railroad tracks. And here's what I find interesting about this. They're unhappy that the railroad company is not cleaning up all that trash. And I thought, you know, I think there's a danger in going that direction, and here's what I'm concerned about. I understand the neighbor's frustration. I'd be frustrated if trash was piling up in my neighborhood as well. But here's the problem. K2 News is saying, well, they're sick and tired of having all this trash piled up there, and they want Union Pacific Railroad to go clean it up. Now, I got no dog in the fight on that one. But the fact is, if you say somebody piled up trash, it wasn't the railroad that put it there, but the railroad should go clean it up. Do you realize where that one can come around and bite you in the backside? Because when people, in this case, homeless drug addicts, start dropping trash on property that's your property, is it your job to clean it up? Is it the people who have allowed the homeless population to do what they're doing, meaning the government's job to clean it up? Whose job is it to clean it up? The minute you say, well, it's the railroad companies because it's their property, the next question I'd ask you is, what are you going to do when the trash starts piling up on your property? And you say, I didn't put it there. And they say, no, but you own the property, so you clean it up. Just understand, that one can come around to bite you. 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, 866-439-5277, and you'll go to the head of the line. Let's go first to George. George, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hi there, Lars. There's an estimated 1.3 million abortions that take place in this country every year, which means at the end of Joe Biden's first term, there will have been an estimated 5.2 million abortions. Hitler killed 7.3 million Jews, and if Joe Biden's given another chance to be reelected, another 5.2 million American babies will die, which means Joe Biden will have killed more American babies than Hitler killed Jews. Hitler's viewed as evil incarnate, whereas the American press portrays poor Joe as a sympathetic grandpa figure, which I'm sure history is going to look back and look at him as a mass-murdering baby butcher.
That's a very good argument. Now, how the two compare, the Nazis were, and Hitler in particular, were mass murderers, and I think that Planned Parenthood and other advocates for abortion are mass murderers as well. I do like the fact that this is now a state issue as opposed to a federal issue, although Joe Biden promises that if he gets control of the House and the Senate and another term in office, God forbid, that he will seek to make abortion a statutory right under federal law. So it's certainly something, and we've got to be concerned because those abortion pills are now half of all the abortions in America, and Joe Biden's trying to make them easier and easier to get, isn't he?
Yeah, they just made them over the counter in New York. There, you don't no longer need a prescription.
And, are you sure?
I think we do need.
Are you sure Mifepristone is available over the counter without a prescription?
That's what I heard last night on one of the news channels. They were.
As I understand it, the FDA had approved Mifepristone, which is RU486, as a prescription drug, but they're also trying to make that easy enough to get, so that it's not over-the-counter, but so that a young lady could get on the phone or get on a Zoom call and have a very quick, very cursory meeting with a doctor, and the doctor would then issue a prescription. So I don't know that they've gone to full over-the-counter like Tylenol and DayQuil, but I'll check into that. George, I appreciate the call. Let's go to Ted in Gig Harbor. Hey, Ted, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hello, Lars. Oh, the gentleman who was talking about government mandates to limit CO2 and all that stuff, you know, I was reminded that, your average volcano emits more CO2 in one eruption than the entire mankind does in a year. The other thing, have you heard this one? There's some island down near Antarctica that's supposedly covered with this, with mice now, and it's supposed to be because of climate change. Have you heard that one?
It's covered with mice because of climate change?
Yes. 200 years ago, some explorers accidentally dropped some mice there, you know, they their ship. And now climate change has caused their population to explode, and now they have to go and kill all those mice for some reason.
Why worry about it? If Al Gore and company are right, the rising sea level will probably, I mean, I don't believe in all that garbage, but if you're a global warming true believer and you believe that the ocean is going to rise by 5 or 10 feet, then we won't have, it's a self-correcting problem. When the ocean gets high enough, unless those mice know how to swim really, really well, they're all done for anyway. But, you know, this is the kind of crazy that we're up against, is people saying, oh, gee, let me grab one more before the break. Let's go to Jane. Hey, Jane, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, you were talking about the Biden selling influence, and yep. Not to sound dramatic or conspiracy theorist, because it's not Thursday yet, but it's Max, it's just quote-unquote selling your soul to the devil. How many of those people in Washington just wanted to get there so bad, and those dollar signs were calling, and once you're there, that's what you do if you don't have any integrity.
I think you're absolutely right about that. And think about this. How many people go into Congress who aren't millionaires already? And how many people leave the Congress or the presidency without getting a whole lot richer? The only person I know who's gone the other direction cost Donald Trump about $1 billion.